Today's Teisho will be on case 24 from the Heikigan Roku, the Pienlu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 24 is entitled Rir Tetsuma, the Old Female Buffalo. Engo's Introduction. Standing on the highest mountaintop, no devil or heretic can approach him. Descending to the farthest depths of the sea, he is not to be seen even by the Buddha's eyes. Even if your eye is like a shooting star and your spirit like lightning, you are still like the turtle, which cannot avoid dragging its tail. In such a predicament, what should you do? See the following. Main subject, Ryu Tetsuma, came to Isan. Isan said, Old female buffalo, so you have come. Tetsuma said, Tomorrow there is a great festival at Taishan, Will you be going? Isan lay down and stretched himself out. Tetsuma went away. Secho's verse. Riding an iron horse, the general entered the double-walled fortress. The imperial proclamation, the six kingdoms are at peace. Still gripping the golden whip, he urges the returning troops. In the quiet depths of the night, no one goes with him through the king's streets. Well, this is day four of our beautiful, beautiful spring sesshin. This precious opportunity to practice together. And everybody has been doing an excellent job. People have been coming into Dokusan with the fruits of their labors on the cushion, and I've been thrilled to see everybody's practice. It really is thrilling. I want to thank you for doing such a good effort and for making such a good effort, and please continue, because the time is running out. We don't have much time left, and there's much to be accomplished. The truth is that there's a huge amount to be accomplished. Koan training might not make much sense. It might seem very strange. If you read books about Zen, you read these stories that are absolutely no sense, right? So this is a good example of one. there's a very famous Zen master whom we ought to really put in our Dharma lineage, and we should, and we will. Her name is Ryu Tetsuma. I don't know the Chinese. She was a Chinese master, actually, and it's been translated here into Japanese. But Ryu was her family name. That's a Japanese pronunciation of a Chinese family name. I don't know what it is. And Tetsuma is her nickname, and Tetsu is iron, and Ma is like a mill for grinding flour. So she was a very formidable Zen master, Chan master. And people were so afraid of her that they say, you don't want to tangle with the iron mill, right? Because if you had Dharma combat with her, she'd grind you up, right? You know. So it was like her perception was so deep that another way to think about it is that she would grind up your illusions and set you free, right? So anyway, she was very widely respected, but people didn't want to challenge her insights because she had a great, deep understanding of all of this. But anyway, this story just seems crazy, right? Rīya Tetsuma came to Isan. Isan's another Zen master. And Isan sees Rīya Tetsuma and he says, "Oh, my old friend, old female buffalo." He's paying her a compliment. You're like, in Asia, of course, you know, people used to have the family buffalo, right? You know, this was in South. No, the family buffalo, it's the most precious thing, right? I mean, you know, the buffalo is you know, how you plow your fields, and it provides fertilizer for your garden, and other things. You know, so the buffalo is like the most. It's like your car, your tractor. And all these things rolled into one, and it's a member of the family. You know, people even treat buffalo sometimes. It's like, you know, I have a wife, three kids, and a buffalo. You know, and this is very important. So, calling somebody an old buffalo is like saying, you know, this is like these people are deep, have a deep friendship, right? And so Isan says, you know, Rīya Tetsuma comes to Isan, and Isan says, "Old female buffalo, so you have come." You know, and Tetsuma decides, "Well, I want to just test. I want to see where your mind is right now. I want to test the quality of your awareness right now." She says, "There's a great festival at Taishan, which is one of the sacred mountains of China, and it's Taishan is in Shaanxi province, and it's sacred to Wen Shu, to Manjushri. So Manjushri is the Bodhisattva most closely associated with Chan, with Zen. So Tetsuma says, "Tomorrow there's a big festival at Taishan. Will you be going?" So, you know, this is really this looks like an ordinary, innocent question, but it's not. It's really a Zen question, and Rīya Tetsuma is saying to her old friend, "Well, let's see where your state of awareness is right now. You know, tell me about something about what goes and what doesn't go, basically, in reality." So it's really not about the festival at Taishan. It's about reality. You know, tell me what moves and what doesn't move in reality. You know, in this moment. Isan is also deeply awake, and he's not taken in by the question. He's not. He doesn't think it's about going to the festival at Taishan. He lies down on the. Lies down on the ground. So if you saw this would make no sense, right? This great Zen master comes to another Zen master. She says, "Are you going to the mountain tomorrow for the festival?" He lies down on the ground. She looks down at him, walks away. end of story, right? You know, this is how Zen people amuse themselves. Doesn't make any sense at all, right? At least to the discriminating mind, and of course many of these koans don't really make any sense to the discriminating mind. So, there's a koan that says it's neither speech nor silence. What is it? See, I mean, if it's not speech, it's silence. If it's not silence, what is it? I don't know. You know. There's a koan that says two monks raise two blinds at the same time. And a Zen master who's watching the two monks says, "One hit, one miss." They're identical monks. They get up at the same time. They grab the cords of the blind at the same time. The blinds are identical blinds. They both go up at the same time. The master looks at one monk and he says, "Hit." He looks at the other monk and he says, "Miss." See? Now, these Zen stories are really designed to help us work through our illusions and encounter reality more fully. The truth is that Zen is really all about encountering reality more fully. And it's difficult to do because we have all of these misconceptions about how things are. Some of this is the product of our own mental habits, and some of this is the product of our culture and education and personal life history. First of all, our mental habits. Now, you know, ordinary consciousness is a consciousness from the standpoint of a fictional character known as the self. Okay? And imagine that we're going through life separate from the world, and that we're looking at the world, but we're not really of the world. You know, we're in the world, but we're not of the world. And it's a little bit like the whole world is a movie, and we're watching the movie. And we're spectators at our own lives. This is ordinary human consciousness. There's a kind of sense of separateness all the time from everything we encounter. And this can be the source of great sadness, right? Perhaps you've had this experience, but you know, you can be with the person you care about and you love, and yet a million miles away, you know? This is quite common. I mean, my brother and I were very different sorts of people, you know? And when I was young, I wanted somehow to communicate with my brother. But he was so different. I mean, my brother and I were just so different. You know, I wanted to be a flower child. And my brother thought he was a character in the Dukes of Hazzard, you know? He had a gun, and he had a Plymouth Duster. You probably don't know what that is, but it was a big yellow macho car that he would drive around. And we were just like from, it was like, did we have the same mother, you know? Did we have the same father? You know, it doesn't seem possible. And so sometimes, even though I was with my brother, you know, there was this, especially when I was with my brother, I think we both felt very lonely. You know, we just couldn't connect, you know. And I think people go through life like that very often. There's a deep sense of disconnection. And we try to solve the problem in various ways, you know. We try to, we make friends. And we can have adventures with people and so on and so on. But you know, at a certain moment, at the end of the day, or at a certain point in our life, it comes. You know, we suddenly become aware of our own isolation. And this is inescapable, as a matter of fact, as long as we're in ordinary consciousness, this sense of being a stranger in a strange land, or being falling on to earth and being in this strange place. This is inescapable as long as our consciousness is centered on the self. The Zen view, the Chan view, is this is fundamentally mistaken, and it's the source of our suffering. The most elemental form of suffering is physical pain, and that too reminds us of our separateness from the world. But there's many different kinds of suffering, and almost all of them, I would say, are related to this sense of separation from the things around us. And there's just no get. You can be a millionaire. You can go to Cancun for a vacation, whatever you want to do. But there's going to be that moment when you suddenly realize you're still alone, yeah, and you're still separate. and there's nothing you can do to get out of it as long as you're in ordinary consciousness. But that consciousness is not real, in my opinion. And so it's very fortunate that we're not trapped in that state of mind. And as long as we're in that state of mind, we can never really see the world as it is. We have other obstacles too. Because let's say that you are in a kind of a fantasy world where you feel you're separate from the world, but you're really part of it. Let's say that's the case. Now let's multiply that by 7.5 billion people, okay? Give or take 500,000 people. And what you have is the world we live in. And all of those people who are all experiencing the world from the standpoint of the separated self have created cultures and literature and arts and so on, and it all sends the message that you're separate from everything around you. This is like the natural state of things. And you can be happy or you can be sad or whatever, but this is sort of like taken for granted. So the ordinary consciousness has this defect, and then culture sort of increases the message that this is how things are. But you know, if you sit on the cushion, you sit still on your meditation cushion, and you watch the breath, you begin to experience a different kind of mindset, different kind of reality. You sit on the cushion, you watch the breath, and you're sitting watching the breath and watching the breath and watching the breath, and you might be thinking, you know, oh brother, you know, what is this all about? You know, I understand my breath. But all of a sudden, you know, you may begin to have a different kind of experience. You're watching the breath, you're watching the breath, you're watching the breath, and suddenly you hear the wind, like we had the beautiful wind yesterday. And all of a sudden the wind just seems like it's so beautiful and it's so intense. And it's because that sense of separation has been taken away, has gone away. And you begin to experience the world in a more connected and immediate way. Our word for this in Zen or Chan is samadhi. This is a non-dualistic awareness, not separate from the world. So this is like stage one in Zen practice, is being able to get outside the illusion of being separate from everything and experiencing the world without a split between yourself and the world, or if philosophers say subject and object. So this is like the first little taste of sanity, right? Sanity, right? And it can be challenging to get there, you know, because when you come to Sesshin, it takes a couple days just to work through all your distractions, you know, getting to the point where you can just be in the moment in a non-separate way takes a couple of days of meditation, usually. And also, it's difficult for us to be in the moment because we have so many expectations and preferences. You know, so you might have gotten up to sit this morning, gotten up to meditate this morning, and you might have been hoping that since it's day four, your legs would have felt a little better, yeah. So maybe you got out of bed thinking, well, I'm sure as the session goes on, my legs are going to feel better. But you got up this morning and, not better, you know? Okay? And then you came in to sit and you thought, geez, I think I'm getting I feel like I have a cold coming on, you know? And I'm tired. You know, why do we only get, you know, why don't we get more sleep, you know? And you might think, you know I could have a good sit if I had the optimal conditions. Right, and it's interesting. Why don't we do that? You know, why don't we have like we'll get up at 7, you know, do some zazen, 7 till 8:30, you know, and so on. But 4:30, you know, somebody was joking who was coming for the session for the first time. He said, "Oh, I see in the schedule it says you get up at 4:30. That's a typo, isn't it?" You know, I thought that was great. Yeah. So you get up at 4:30 and you drag your ass in here and you sit down on the cushion. And, you know, let's face it, the image we have of reality is that we're supposed to sit on the cushion, not too much pain in the legs, you know, and you start watching the breath, and pretty soon, bliss, right? You know, bliss. And then, you know, enlightenment, right? And then everything's going to get light, and, you know, you're going to, this is great, this is wonderful. So instead you sit down on the cushion and your knees hurt, your legs hurt, right? Maybe your stomach is upset, maybe your head is hurting because you have allergies or you have a cold or something, and you're tired, and you keep thinking about something that happened at work, you know, and it's hard to be in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have quite a long list of expectations, right? And so the most elementary part of Zen practice, which is non-dualistic awareness, is difficult to achieve because of our expectations. And we sit on the cushion, and we might also be thinking, oh my God, I've been working on this koan for 3 months. You know, I'll be old before I, you know, Kurt said Genki Roshi answered, you know, 12 koans in one session. You know, I haven't answered 12 in my life. I haven't answered 2 in my life. You know, so that could be in there too, right? You sit there on the cushion and you might be thinking, I hate this, 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 right? And this is dualistic awareness, right? This is the separated mind. This reality, you know, this world just isn't good enough for me. You know, it's just not good enough for me. And you sit there and think, I hate it, 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 I hate it. But you know, a strange thing can happen to you. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're thinking, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. You know, when is he going to ring that? When is that idiot going to ring the bell? You know? And then, you know, you think, all right, fine. You know, I'll play your stupid game. You know, I'll watch my breath, you know. And then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you just, all of a sudden, you know, the strangest thing is, you know, You can suddenly realize, you know, my legs hurt, I'm tired, I have an upset stomach, I have a cold, but damn it, I'm so happy. See, and that's the strange, that runs counter to everything our culture says, right? Happiness means you have to have this, 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 right? But strangely, you know, strangely, none of those are like the secret to happiness. They just, I mean, people say that all the time, it's, you know, but they don't act like they believe it. But you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath and you feel rotten and you feel grouchy and et cetera, et cetera. And you know you're not going to answer your damn call, you know. But all of a sudden, you feel wonderful. Or you get off the cushion, you know, and the whole time you're struggling with something going on in your head, and you start going into the dining room to eat, and you look down at your oatmeal and you think, I am so damn happy, you know? And there's no reason, right? There's no reason you're happy, but what's happened is the boundary between yourself and the world has gone away. And this is so wonderful. This is the fact that this can happen, I think, is the most astonishing thing. And if Zen did nothing else, you know, people talk about enlightenment and so on, but if we could do nothing else but this, I think this practice would be infinitely precious. Just to get beyond that boundary, you know. And every morning we recite the Shinshin Mei, the Shinshin Mei. Which is translated as verses on the heart mind, or verses on the faith mind. The words we recite go like this. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. And I'll skip down a little bit. The way is perfect, where like vast space, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Indeed, it is due to our choosing to accept or reject that we do not see the true nature of things. You know, you think, oh, that's so beautiful. But the way, life right now is perfect, like vast space, right? And you read these beautiful lines and you might think, well, that's easy for him to say. You know, he didn't get up at 4:30. You know, he's just some monk living in China. They didn't have any problems back then, you know. And you could say, you know, he had his 3 square meals a day. You know, he just could get up and meditate, and he doesn't have to. But you know, whenever I recite these lines, or often when I recite these lines, it always occurs to me that the author of these lines had leprosy. This is something I just think it's crucially important to understand, you know, that the person who wrote these lines wrote them maybe with some of his fingers missing, you know? And in those days in China, leprosy was an incurable disease, right? And of course, in China, as in Europe, lepers were looked down upon as out of favor with the universe. So here's a person most people wouldn't even want to associate with. And as somebody who's, we would say, suffering, but not suffering, actually, we would say. But he's telling us, actually, you know, suffering, pain is inescapable, right? Pain is inescapable. If you're alive, you're going to be in pain. But suffering, when you suffer, it's a sign that your mind is too small. Okay? So we need to be a little bit precise about this. And pain is not something you can avoid. In fact, trying to avoid pain just makes more pain. Everything you do in life is going to cause some pain, and if you run from pain, you'll run from everything in life. But there's a difference between pain and suffering. And the difference is whether you're living in your small self or whether you've gotten beyond that and you're connecting with the universe. And this is a person who has had a lot of suffering, but he's been able to connect. Yeah. And I do think this is true. You know, whenever I'm suffering, I always remind myself it's because I'm not in my big mind. Now, look, there's a New Age doctrine that says that people get sick because of their mental attitude. And I would like to go on record as saying I think that's baloney, okay? It is. I've known people who are deeply enlightened who die of cancer, you know? And so I just don't believe it. You know, the Dalai Lama is going to die of cancer. He's going to get heart disease or something. And you could say, oh, if only he was optimistic, you know? It's like, no. That's not true. And by the way, you know, the Buddha didn't say everything is karma. Many people don't understand that. That was not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha actually said some things are karma and some things are accident. Yes, he said that. So for example, karma would be like this. You have a hot temper. You're driving on the Garden State Parkway where we know everybody's very polite. And you're driving and some maniac cuts you off, right? And you think, damn it, I'm not going to let him get away with that, you know? And then you swing over, but you didn't look in your side mirror, and you clip somebody. And both, you know, and so there's a big wreck. See, now that's karma, right? Okay. But let's say you're driving along in your car, and you're having a nice day, and so on, and then a deer jumps out, and you hit the deer. That's not karma. That's an accident. You know, so there's a difference. Just wanted to get that in there. Okay, but the thing is, pain is inescapable, but suffering is because your mind is too small. Yeah, And so when we're suffering, we're sitting on the cushion going, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. Please remember, the problem is you. You know, the problem is 100% you. It's not the temperature. And by the way, I say I hate it too. And I just remind myself, well, wait a minute. You know, buddy. You know? The problem is me. You know, it's not the temperature. It's not the condition. It's me. You know, so it's always a challenge. Presence of suffering is a challenge, and it shows us the limits of our mind. And our job becomes to go beyond that suffering, and we have to just. And how do you get beyond suffering? You leave the small self behind. You enter the big self. And when the little self disappears, the problem of suffering also disappears. It's like a change in perspective. You know, it's like when you're looking through the wrong end of the telescope. You know, everything looks small. When you look through the right end of the telescope, like, gosh, that's amazing. You know. So we tend to look through the wrong end of the telescope, and when we see things from the right perspective, everything is quite beautiful, right? Even our own death can be quite beautiful. You know, I've talked about this before. In Seattle, at one time, a friend of Genki Roshi's was dying of cancer, and I was very attentive to this because, you know, if you're in my family, you're going to die of cancer, pretty much. It's like as soon as people are born, they could just stamp a little, you know, something on their arm that says "going to die of cancer," because it just seems to be in the genes. But you know, basically, this guy was so happy, and sometimes he would get really tired. You know, he'd have to go rest, but he was so bright. You know, I don't mean intelligent. I mean the way he lived was so bright. You know, it right up till the end. It was very powerful. It was that there were a couple of incidents like that in my life that convinced me there was something to this Zen path. You know. So anyway, stage one is where we often find ourselves early in the morning, right? Yeah, and we're trying to get past the little mind that says, "I want to wake up at 7." Blah blah blah. You know. And we hate it, we hate it, we hate it, and then boom, you connect, right? And all of a sudden, it's so beautiful. And this is a strategy you can use. To in more advanced practice, you know. Now, please understand what I'm about to say, because this has to be taken the right way. You can deepen your experience of the big mind in a way by raising the stakes. And what I mean by this is, you know, you've heard stories of these guys in Tibet, these monks in Tibet who go out and sit in the snow, right? And you think, oh, that must be so cool. You know, those guys go out in the snow. I'm sure the snow doesn't bother them because they have mystic powers, you know. But it's not like, that's what I always thought, you know. But actually, if you go out and sit in the snow in your light cotton outfit, you know, you freeze your ass off, right? It's cold. So you're sitting there and it's like, oh my God, this is so cold. You know, where's the mystic powers? Well, you have mystic powers, right? Watch the breath. Go to the blankness at the end of your breath, or you call Mu, you go into that blankness. And you think, ooh, I'm so cold, right? You know, we used to have a temple up in the mountains in Washington State, and there was no insulation, and in our fall and spring sessions, it was so cold, we'd just sit there and shiver. But you can use that to go deeper, you know? If you're sitting again, please be careful about what I'm saying. Zen is not about enduring pain, right? That has nothing to do with what we're doing. But challenges can help us, challenging circumstances can help us to go deeper. And if you go deeper, if you drop the small self in a way that's quite profound, you can have deeper insight. So if you're having trouble with your koan, if you feel like you're not answering your koan, you know, one solution is to go sit in the snow, but we don't have any snow. You know? So another solution would be to not take a break when the bell rings. So if you're saying, I just can't get anywhere with this stupid koan, you know, my advice is to raise the stakes. It's like gambling, right? You know, so you're playing poker and you say, I'll throw in another $5. Nobody probably plays with $5, but I'll throw in another $100, right? So now the game is a more high stakes game, right? So you're unhappy with your koan practice, and you the bell rings, and normally what you say is, oh, thank God the bell rang. But what you say instead is, okay, I'm going to try to drop my small self more deeply. And I'm going to do it by not uncrossing my legs or not moving my legs during this next sit. Now this won't work if you're a beginner and you're beyond your limitations. So if you're just sitting there in agony for half an hour, you're wasting your time. Do not do that. Okay? So if you're just sitting there thinking, oh, this is so painful, you know, that's not productive. But there's a way of practicing where what you do is you're not in agony, but you're pushing back on your discomfort. So you're using the breath to sweep away your pain. And you're using the breath to sweep away your pain. You're using the breath to sweep away your pain. You know, and in that state, you can really drop the small self and enter this bigger mind. And believe it or not, you know, I can hear it. People who are doing the Mu koan come in to see me, you know, and they're supposed to call Mu. And, you know, it's pretty easy to hear a self-conscious or overly intellectual Mu. But sometimes people come in and I can see that they've sort of squeezed themselves out of their small selves, you know. And as I say, this is not about pain, but you can challenge yourself. Yeah, and when you challenge yourself in this way, you can go very deeply. And indeed, people become like Ryu Tetsuma, the old female buffalo, or Isan, by doing just this. Right? This is they have made a dedicated practice of not always moving when the bell rings, and pushing beyond the small self, yeah. And so this is a very simple practice, but much is at stake here. If you want to make progress in your koan, pain is not the answer, but using the challenges of your circumstances to go deeper is really the way, you know. And it works every time. You know, I too sit on the cushion and think, I hate this. But then, you know, you just go deeper and deeper and deeper, and finally it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. I also want to say something about, well, once you're in that state, let me put it this way, once you're in that state where the small self is quite far away and you're in an undivided mind, you can begin to experience reality in a way that the divided mind can't experience. And the koan is actually guiding you to some aspect of reality. And it's very, very difficult to notice, and it takes great mental focus and great stillness. It would be much easier to look at the head of a pin, really, because this is so requires such attention. Again, our common sense assumptions keep getting in the way. So you know, if you're working on the breath perception koan, maybe your idea is that you're going to have some kind of a mystical experience. So you're watching your breath, and you're waiting for like an earthquake to happen, right? Or something like that, you know, or a big flash of light. And you know, so you're sitting on the cushion, you're waiting for a flash of light or something like that, an earthquake, and you're watching the breath, and you sort of notice out of the corner of your mind, that's odd, it feels like my hands and my face are disappearing. Then you think, but that's unimportant. Where's the flash of light, right? See, you've just walked by something that's very important because you're looking for something else. This is an example of how our expectations get in the way of our experience of reality. So if you could come in to see the teacher in Dokusan and say, how's it going with your breath? You could say, nothing's happening. And then you go back and you sit down and think, oh yeah, I feel like I'm expanding, but that's unimportant. You know, where's the light? You know, where's the insight? You know, and you miss it again. So people can go through this at very deep levels of concentration. You may notice things that you might not take seriously at first because they don't match up with conventional ways of thinking. But Zen practice is not a philosophy. You know, what you want to do is pretty much just report on what's actually happening. So people keep trying to have a certain kind of experience or to have a certain kind of insight. But you just have to be observant about what actually happens. So if you're watching the breath, and somebody might come in and say, you know, I watched my breath, and then all of a sudden it felt like my hands and my face were disappearing. And I say, great, excellent. You know, you're in samadhi. It's hard, though, for people to be honest sometime or to put aside their assumptions. And sometimes you will be aware of things that might not make sense intellectually. You know, people do koans and they come in and they tell me what's happening and I go, great, you've passed this koan. And it's like, huh? You know, and they have no idea. I mean, this happened to me all the time. I'd go in and I'd tell Genki Roshi something and he didn't go, great, he went, you know, or something. He'd say, oh, well, okay. Now that's all. I guess I can accept that answer, you know. And they say, here's your new koan, you know. And I think, huh? It was like something went by, but I didn't even see it, you know. So I guess I answered the call, and I don't know what I did, you know. I couldn't. A long time, your practice may be like that, because it's not all going to fit together for a long time. In fact, the desire to have it all fit together could be a stumbling block. So there's a famous old parable from India, from ancient India, ancient Buddhism. And the Buddha said, you know, really, the world that you experience when you're no longer in your small mind is vast. And it's really vast. It's infinitely vast. And it's much bigger than yes or no, right or wrong, black or white, and so on. And because we think in these narrow terms, it's hard for us to appreciate it. But little by little, we begin to encounter it. But it's like blind men feeling an elephant. So, you know, if the koan is directing you to some aspect of reality, you don't know what aspect it is, right? So you're sitting there in darkness and blankness, and you don't know what to do. And you could try to figure it out, you know, with your discriminating mind. But that isn't going to get you anywhere. So basically, you have to just sit there until you can use big mind kicks in. But the answer you get may make absolutely no sense. And you can go in and it's like saying, you know, the koan's saying, just the koan saying it's round. You know, the koan wouldn't even say it that directly. It would say something like, so-and-so drew a circle in the dirt, okay? And so you think, circle, 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 circle. And then you're blind, but you're in the zoo, right? and you go up to the elephant and you grab the elephant's leg and you think, this is it, right? It's round. It's like a circle. And then you go to the teacher and say, I found it. It was like a tree trunk. And the teacher says, ah, perfect. Now go back. This time it's squiggly, right? Mm-hmm. Then you go back and you grab the, you know, the snout. This is it. It's squiggly, right? You go back and say, you know, it's like a nose, only it moved around, you know? Good. See? So that's how it goes. That's koan training. Little by little, the whole elephant begins to emerge. That's really the truth. And when you see enough of the elephant, not intellectually, it's not an intellectual recognition, but when you see enough of the elephant, when you experience enough of the elephant, the boundary between the self and world, it crumbles in a very decisive way, and it never goes up again. Ever again, and this is a very powerful experience, and it's called Daikensho, and it's in the future if you keep practicing. In your future, if you keep practicing. So this is what all this crazy Zen stuff is about: experiencing reality, which is quite amazing, quite wonderful. And beyond, even if we were grateful every minute of the day, we couldn't have enough gratitude for how wonderful this world really is. And I feel that way about this practice. Even if I could be grateful, I'm very far from being grateful every minute of the day. But if I could be, I still wouldn't be grateful enough. For I think this beautiful path, to liberation. So many of you are struggling with the small self. Many of you are sitting in blankness, and maybe you're frustrated. You're thinking, you know, I don't know, there's no way, you know, somebody came in and complained, and it was just like music to my ears, right? Somebody came in and said, I have nowhere to stand with this koan. I can't get a grip on it anywhere. I feel like I don't know what I'm doing. It's just like, oh, music to my ears, right? Perfect. Like, ah, oh, thank God, right? It's like, ah, oh, perfect, right? Because, you know, there's some koans that are just so well made that there's no way to even get the slightest hint intellectually. You know, I just love that. You know? That's great. So you have to use your mu power. You have to use your, and if you're frustrated, you know, just don't move when the bell rings. Pull those legs up, you know, and now again, it's not about pain. So there's a point at which it's not productive to be in pain. But, you know, if you can pull your legs up over your thighs, or you can sit without moving for, you know, two or three sits, and you might feel like you're going to die, but if you're not in pain, if you're just uncomfortable, you know, you get through that panic. You know, there's like a panic. You think, oh my God, you know. Then somebody came in and said this in a Dokusan. I don't think the person would mind. The person said, you know, the funny thing is I realize that my pain isn't really infinite. There's just a limit to it. You know, so I'm in pain, but it's not going to get any worse than this. And so I didn't move. And then he said it came and it went in waves, you know. And again, I just thought, perfect, right? That's how it is for me too. You know, at first there's like this panic, like, oh my God, this will be unstoppable and there'll be no end. And then you realize, wait a minute. You know, it's okay. I can live with this. And you go deep into Mushin. And pretty soon, you know, your mind becomes very clear, very still, like a lake, you know, like a windless lake. And then we can begin to explore reality, and the more we experience the world as it actually is, happier we're going to be. And of course, these two people know this very well. Ryu Tetsuma came to Isan. Isan said, "All female buffalo, so you have come." See. Someday, I hope all of you are like Isan and Ryu Tetsuma. it would be wonderful, right? In my dream world, I'm, you know, everybody has fantasies. I have fantasies too. In my dream world, you know, I'm going to be like 85 years old, and you all are going to be like great Zen practitioners, right? And I'm going to go to your session and think, oh crap, this is so hard. In my dream, I'll say, well, what have I done? I created monsters.